back and do the life of Christ on the outline here, just as a way of a reminder. We're going to finish up the civil trial, which we've been concentrating on, of Jesus. And we've looked at, or we've reviewed, Jesus' first trial before Pilate, his trial before Herod, and his second trial before Pilate. Pilate, again, really wanted to just wash his hands of Jesus and didn't want to condemn him to death, did not want to do it, but really got forced into it. And, I don't want to exculpate him. He did it. But you could tell that he did not want to. And so now we're at the mockery, and this is one of many mockeries, but it's the final mockery of this civil trial stage. And so let's go to Mark chapter 15. And at Mark chapter 15, could someone read verses 16 through 19?
Soldiers took him away into the palace, that is, the Praetorium, and they called together the whole Roman cohort. They dressed him up in purple, and after twisting a crown of thorns, they put it on him. And they began to acclaim him, "Hail, King of the Jews." They kept beating his head with a reed and spitting on him and kneeling and bowing before him.
Thanks, Lou. And let's also take a look at Matthew chapter 27. And at Matthew 27, could someone read verses 27 through 30?
Then the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the Praetorium, and gathered the whole garrison around him. And they stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him. When they had twisted a crown of thorns, they had put it on his head, and a reed in his right hand. And they bowed and kneed before him and mocked him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews." Then they spat on him and took the reed and struck him on his head.
Okay, thanks, Rod. So, again, this is the conclusion of this trial, civil trial process for Jesus. And looking at Matthew chapter 27, verse 27, the soldiers of the governor took, which is Pilate, took Jesus into the Praetorium. This is the Roman garrison, like Rod's version says, where Rome kept control of Jerusalem during Passover. And verse 27 goes on to say that they gathered the whole Roman cohort around him. And if you can recall, a Roman cohort is a military subdivision of the Roman Empire. And the same cohort appeared in the Garden of Gethsemane for the arrest of Jesus. Well, here they gather around him, and this is their time for fun. And this is their time to have a good time. And they've mocked him and beat him before, but this is just the final capstone to the whole treatment that Jesus has endured before his crucifixion. Verse 28, they stripped him, so he's naked. Then they take his clothes off. Then they put a scarlet or a purple robe on him, signifying royalty. And in this idea of a twisted form of royalty, they take a crown of thorns, which is probably just some bushes in Israel there. Like a rose bush, basically. And they jam it on his head. And they put a reed in his right hand, sort of like a mock scepter, mock crown. And then after they jam this, and again, he's had the beat down pretty significantly. He's been scourged, so he's pretty raw. So after they do this, put the robe on him, put this crown of thorns on him, put the reed on him, then what do these guys do? What do these military guys do?
Starts mocking him.
And yeah, but interesting. What do they do before that?
Kneel down.
They bow down to him. Now, of course, they're doing it mockingly. But it is a precursor to what even the enemies of Jesus Christ will one day do.
Every knee will bow.
Every knee will bow. Every tongue will confess. And these guys are doing it as a joke. But it is a foreshadowing of what will be a global phenomenon at some point in the future. And they're mocking him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews." Of course, they're claiming that because he's claimed to be King of the Jews. He's claimed to be the Messianic King of Israel. They spit on him. They take his unread and they beat him on the head. So that concludes the trial. Now we're going to go on to the crucifixion. And we're going to cover the crucifixion in a number of parts. We're going to start here with the procession to Golgotha. So let's go to John chapter 19. Specifically, we're going to take a look at verses 16 and 17. So the next, the crucifixion phase of the life of the Messiah, we're going to look at it in 32 different stages. From going to Golgotha to the tomb, we're going to divvy this up into 32 distinct segments or stages as we review these scriptures. So this procession of Golgotha is the first five of these 32 stages we're going to look at. And we're going to start by looking at John chapter 19. Could someone read verses 16 and 17?
Finally, Pilate handed him over to be crucified. So the soldiers took charge of Jesus. Carrying his own cross, he went out to the place of the skull, which in Aramaic is called Golgotha.
Okay, thanks, Paul. So civil trial's done. Now they're going to pronounce the execution, which is a Roman form, a Gentile form of execution, which is crucifixion. And in verse 17, typically, as what it typically happens for someone sentenced to die through crucifixion, he has to bear his own cross. He has to take his own cross to this place they're going to crucify him at. Now, since he's in Jerusalem, and generally, any other place in the world, they wouldn't make him go out to some other place. They'd find a place real close by and just crucify him right there. But because there can't be any dead bodies in Jerusalem during Passover, they've got to get outside the city walls. So that's why, or the temple area.
Does Pilate and the Romans know that, or the Jews are just making sure they enforce that?
I think barbaric and as intense as the Romans are. I think they do have some cultural sensitivity, not necessarily to be nice to the Jews, but in order to not instigate any riots. So they got to go to this place that is in Hebrew called Golgotha.
So probably this is from the Praetorium. He's got to then go.
That's exactly right. And no one knows where this place is today. I mean, there's two major theories place it pretty close to what is today known as the Church of the Sepulchre, which is it's shared between the Roman Catholic Church, the Armenian Church, and the Greek Orthodox Church. But then most evangelicals believe that it's really even farther outside of Jerusalem. And I'll bring in actually photos of the place that a lot of evangelicals believe it is, archaeologists. But it's called the place of the skull. That's the translation in Hebrew. And this place where I've been, where they think it may be a candidate, it is interesting when you look at the mountainside or the hill, it does look eerily like the shape of a face of a skull. But in Latin, this word is translated into Latin as Calvary. So this is where we get the word Calvary from. Calvary is a translation from the Hebrew Golgotha into Latin. So the first stage of this 32 stages we're going to look at is the fact that he's got to carry his own cross. He's bearing his own cross from the place of the verdict to the place of execution. Let's go to Mark chapter 15. And at Mark chapter 15, could someone read verses 20 through 23?
And when they had mocked him, they took off the purple robe and put his own clothes on him. Then they led him out to crucify him. A certain man from Cyrene, Simon, the father of Alexander and Rufus, was passing by on his way in from the country, and they forced him to carry the cross. They brought Jesus to the place called Golgotha, which means the place of the skull. Then they offered him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it.
Okay, good. So, similar to John, we learn that they lead him away from the Praetorium for crucifixion. But we learn a new fact in Mark's account, verse 21. What do we learn in verse 21?
They took an individual and helped Jesus bear that cross.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So this is the second stage of this crucifixion process we're going to see, is that not only does he bear his own cross, but at some point during this process, the Romans require someone else to bear his cross. And what's this guy's name?
Simon of Cyrene.
Simon, okay. Cyrus.
Why they put in there the father of Alexander and Rufus? What significance is Alexander and Rufus?
Yeah, good question. Let's go to Mark chapter 6, or also go to Romans chapter 16.
Romans chapter 16, okay.
And at Romans chapter 16, Romans is Paul's letter to this Gentile city, the capital of the Roman Empire, Rome, and it's to the ecclesia, the gathering of called out believers, Jew and Gentile, who meet in Rome. And the end of this letter, Paul has a number of instructions. And one of the instructions, could someone read chapter 16, verse 13?
Yeah, greet Rufus, a choice man in the Lord, also his mother and mine.
So it's like people believe that, based on Paul's reference to Rufus, and again, there may be a zillion Rufuses at the time, so this is just pure conjecture, but people believe that Mark's parenthetical in his testimony is that what happened, because why would you put a parenthetical like that in there? It's likely that Simon became a believer and became known in the community of believers. His wife became a believer, and his children, Rufus and Alexander, became believers. And probably were closely associated with Paul, and therefore Mark is letting his readers know. Because remember, Mark's gospel is written to Romans.
Right.
Mark's gospel is written by, Peter and Mark are writing to folks in Rome. And Rufus may be in Rome. This is probably the same Rufus, and it's probably the son of Simon. And so Simon, again, conjecture. But Simon was likely, after this event, became a believer with his wife and with his two sons.
Cool, thank you.
And Mark's telling us that, in retrospect. Cyrene, anyone know where Cyrene is? This guy, Simon, is from Cyrene. Anyone know where Cyrene is at? Or what Cyrene is?
It's in the Mediterranean.
Yeah, it's Libya. It's Benghazi.
Oh.
Yeah, so there was a significant Jewish population in Libya at this time. And so it's logical that Simon, as a Jew, would have left Libya, or Cyrene at the time, go through Egypt to Jerusalem for Passover. Some people think he's African, black African. It could be. Not likely. Most black Africans are sub-Saharan. This is North Africa. He's probably just a Jewish guy. But he could be black.
Some people think Acts 13:1 talks about him too, but...
Yeah. Actually, why don't you read it?
In the church at Antioch, there were prophets and teachers, Barnabas, Simeon called Niger, Lucius of Cyrene, Manion, who had been brought up with Herod, and Saul.
So, if that is another allusion, it makes the point that Mark is probably saying, hey, you know, this is the guy we all know.
Gotcha.
Why do you think that they have to get someone to carry Jesus' cross for him?
Because he was so...
He was scourged. I mean, he's probably not even able to walk. He's probably may even be being dragged. So just as a logistical issue, they've got to get someone else to do it.
Wasn't like compassion.
No, that's exactly, no, not at all.
No, you can't die here. Come on.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. Let's go to Luke chapter 23. And at Luke 23, could someone read verses 26 through 33? 26 through 33.
Now as they led him away, they laid hold of a certain man, Simon a Cyrene, who was coming from the country, and on him they laid the cross, that he might bear it after Jesus. And a great multitude of people followed him, and women who also murmured and lamented him. But Jesus, turning to them, said, Daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children. For indeed the days are coming in which they will say, Blessed are the barren, the wombs that never bore, and the breasts which never nursed. Then they will begin to say to the mountains, fall on us, and to the hills, cover us. For if they do these things in the green wood, what would be done in the dry? There was also two other criminals led with him to be put to death. And when they had come to that place called Calvary, there they crucified him and the criminals, one of them on the right hand and the other on the left.
Okay, thank you, Barry. So they lead him. So again, we know the same details in verse 26 that we've read in Mark and John's account. But we learn something new in verse 27. What do we learn in verse 27?
A large crowd of women.
Yeah. So there's a large crowd following them. They're probably both people who are empathetic and sympathetic to him, but also maybe people that are mocking him.
Yeah.
And then there's also a large contingent of women who are mourning and lamenting the fact that what's going on. And so Jesus says something interesting to these women who are mourning his execution. What does he tell them?
Don't worry about me. Mourn yourself and what's to come, basically.
He's basically saying, that's exactly right. He's saying, I'm not the one you need to be worried about.
Mm-hmm.
Daughters of Jerusalem, stop weeping for me, but weep for yourselves and your children. For behold, the days are coming when they will say, blessed are the barren and the wombs that never bore and the breasts that never nursed. In other words, Jesus is saying it's going to get bad here. So bad that people will say it would be better if you were never even born. You have to endure what's going to happen. And Jesus then goes on to say in verse 30, these same people that make these observations that you're going to be part of, ladies, will say to the mountains, fall on us, and to the hills, cover us. So the idea is that it's pretty a cataclysmic event they're going to experience.
Is that a reflection to the Revelation?
Yeah, so good. So this, it is. And let's talk about that. Jesus actually quotes two prophets here. And let's take a look at them. Let's look at Isaiah chapter 2. So Jesus quotes scripture when he says this.
Isn't this part of when Rome's going to be taking over?
Yes.
It's immediate.
Yeah, so there are, after we read Isaiah, let's go back to what you're mentioning here, Paul, as to what Jesus is getting at. Isaiah chapter 2.
Oh, chapter.
Yeah, so Isaiah chapter 2, and this is a prophecy from Isaiah the prophet 700 years earlier. And when someone gets to Isaiah chapter 2, could they read verses 19 through 22?
Men will flee to caves and the rocks and the holes in the ground from dread of the Lord and the splendor of his majesty when he rises to shake the earth. In that day men will throw away to the rodents and bats that are idols of silver and idols of gold which they made to worship. They will flee to caverns and the rocks and to the overhanging crags from dread of the Lord and the splendor of his majesty when he rises to shake the earth. Stop trusting in man who has put a breath in his nostrils. Of what account is he?
Okay, thanks, Jeff. So, this is Isaiah giving a prophecy of a future judgment on Jerusalem. And in specifically, in verse 21 of chapter 2, he says that the people that are going to be judged at this time will go into the caverns of the rocks and the cliffs before the terror of the Lord and the splendor of his majesty when he arises to make the earth tremble. So Isaiah refers to this kind of global event of cataclysm where people are actually going to seek refuge in hills and in mountains. Let's go to Hosea chapter 10, the prophet Hosea. I'll go ahead and read it. It is Hosea chapter 10. The prophet Hosea says this in verse 8. and this is Hosea making a prophecy of Israel. Also the high places of Avon, the sin of Israel, will be destroyed. Thorn and thistle will grow on their altars. Then they will say, this is people of Israel, to the mountains, cover us, and to the hills, fall on us. So both of these prophecies refer to judgments upon Israel by Yahweh. that are so bad that the very people themselves say, look, we want the mountains to destroy us because we can't take it anymore. So the question becomes, we're going to go to Revelation in a second. Look, okay. The question becomes, when Jesus tells these women this, when Jesus tells these women, look, even though I'm going to get crucified, don't cry for me, cry for you and your children. We can conclude, based on looking back at history, what happened after Jesus was crucified, that this was, Jesus was talking to these women about what they would experience in Israel when Rome came in 40 years later, within a generation after Jesus' death, and completely destroyed Jerusalem and destroyed the temple and killed 9/10 of the population. So that was a significant judgment that came upon Israel. But there is also the likelihood that there's a double fulfillment here, or another fulfillment that's even beyond the lives of these women. And this is probably what Isaiah is getting to. This larger period that we would call now the Great Tribulation. Gotcha. And because after Jesus says this, referring to the prophets Hosea and Isaiah, another prophet... who was also an apostle, 60 years after Jesus says this, and 20 years after the Rome destroys Jerusalem in 95 AD on the island of Patmos, John also has a prophecy, an apocalypsis, an unveiling from Jesus Christ, and that's recorded at Revelation chapter 6. Let's go to Revelation chapter 6. And so Revelation chapter 6, since it was written 20 plus years after the destruction of Jerusalem, can't be referring to that event. It has to be referring to an event that is future to that event, an event which I believe is still yet to come, that we would call the Great Tribulation. And Revelation chapter 6, could someone read verses 15 through 17?
And the kings of the earth, and the great men, and the commanders, and the rich and the strong, and every slave and free man hid themselves in the caves among the rocks of the mountains. And they said to the mountains and to the rocks, fall on us and hide us from the presence of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For a great day of their wrath has come, and who is able to stand?
Okay, thanks, Lou. So John, who's here with Jesus, in 30 AD, as we see greet Jesus walking through the streets of Jerusalem, 60 years later, receives from the same Jesus this vision, and John is told that at some future date, the kings of the earth, so not just Israel and not just Jerusalem, but the kings of the earth and the great men and the commanders and the rich and the strong, every man, will have hid themselves in caves among the rocks of mountains. And these same people, great people of the earth at this time, are going to cry out to the rocks and the mountains, fall on us and hide us. Hide us from who? Yeah. Him who sits on the throne.
Yes.
Because this is a period of wrath. And verse 16 of chapter 6 of Revelation specifically tells us this is a time of the wrath of who? The Lamb.
Jesus
Christ.
Yep.
You don't really see a Lamb being vengeful.
That's
or
when you read it, just the wrath, the Lamb, it just doesn't...
I know.
Doesn't
lamb,
go together
gentle, and, wrath,
right.
Brutal.
Yeah. Yeah. And the idea is that when he came to offer his kingship the first time around, he came as a Lamb.
Mm-hmm.
But when he after his rejection and when he returns to take his place as king,
it's
going to be a time of wrath. And not just for Israel, but the entire world.
Is that where the saying comes from? Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord.
Yeah, well, I think that's part of it. That's the ultimate vengeance. So yeah, when Jesus comes back, it's not going to be a good time. Not at all. And so Jesus is, coming back to Luke, let's tie this up. Coming back to Luke.
Is that when he comes back on the horse, or that's after that?
Okay. But there's a period of judgment before he actually returns, and this is what these guys are talking about, where he... There's a kind of a repeat of the plagues upon Egypt that happened upon the whole world.
And the horse is after that?
The horse is the very end of that time period.
But we ain't here.
Hopefully we're not here. I mean, yeah, I don't believe we're here.
I don't believe we're here either.
I think that that's why we, each one of us, need to know why we are pre-trib people, why we believe that we're going to be raptured up.
Yeah, so the idea is that, yeah, so the idea of we not being here, if you read what Paul teaches, Paul, I believe that Paul teaches very plainly that we will escape the day of wrath that is coming upon the world. And that would be through an event that would be called the rapture, where you get this idea of a pre-tribulation rapture, that the ecclesia will be evacuated from earth before judgment, the wrath of God, is poured out. Because what's the point of redeeming the bride of Christ if it's going to suffer his wrath? That's illogical. It's nonsensical. It's theologically corrupt. So the spotless, blameless bride of Messiah Yeshua, his ecclesia, will not be participating in the wrath that is due upon the whole world. That's also the culmination of all the sin from Adam till that time.
Jeremiah, I thought, Dr. Jeremiah put it very, very well, in my mind anyway, is that why would I not want to go ahead and leave this earth right now while I'm alive? If I believe that there was going to be, I had to go through the tribulation. Because those 3.5 years that are going to be tribulation are going to be just utter starvation, killing. You went overseas and you see killing going on, you know. But nothing like that is going to compare to what's going to happen during the tribulation. He said, if I believe that I was mid-trib, I would want to die now, because it's a matter of where it indicates that the dead will rise. And so it would make more sense for you to go ahead and die before the rapture happens and everything else, or through the tribulation, so that you don't go through.
Well, that's the interesting thing about this idea of a rapture. It includes not just the people who are dead, but also who else?
Right. The believers.
Those who are alive in Christ. They actually follow those who are dead.
Yeah,
right. It's very interesting. So, but coming back to Luke, Jesus tells these women, look, so I don't think Jesus is talking about this global apocalypse that's mentioned in Revelation. I think he's talking about the Roman judgment in Jerusalem, because he says it's your children that are going to deal with this. But back at Luke chapter 23, nonetheless, he says this when Rome, kicks everyone's ass around here, that's coming after I'm gone, the folks around here are going to say, we want the mountains to fall on us, because it's going to be better that happened than we have to endure what Rome and Titus and Vespasian are going to put on us. Chapter 23 of Luke, verse 31, for if they do these things when the tree is green, what will happen when it is dry? The idea, Jesus is, the figurative language Jesus is using here, is that if you see what's going on here and you think it's bad now, really things are going well compared, the tree is green now compared to how it's going to be. And so similarly, when we bemoan how bad the world is, and believe me, it's bad. I'm not saying it's not. It's really bad. It's really wicked. It is nothing compared to how it will be when the wrath of God comes upon the earth. Because if you do believe that there is a rapture event, and you do believe the ecclesia is taken off of the earth, it also means that the restrainer, the one who restrains evil now, evil is being restrained right now. But at some point, that restraint will be removed from the earth, mm-hmm. allowing the wrath of God to proceed. And you think it's bad now, don't kid yourself. It's not, this is a honeymoon period compared to what it's going to be like. Let's take a look at, also staying in Luke, verse 32, we also learned that other criminals are being led away, not Barabbas, but two other guys are being led away to be put to death with him. And let's go to Matthew chapter 27. We'll finish with Matthew.
And Rob wanted a few minutes at the end, so if we could maybe...
Yeah, so we just...
Minutes early.
Yeah, last few verses here in Matthew 27. Could someone read verses 31 through 34?
And when they had mocked him, they took the robe off him, put his own clothes on him, and led him away to be crucified. Now as they came out, they found a man of Cyrene, Simon by name. Him they compelled to bear his cross, and then they had come to a place called Golgotha, that was to say the place of the skull. They gave him sour wine mingled with the gall to drink, but when he had tasted it, he would not drink.
Okay, thanks, Rod. So in these four Gospels we've learned, Jesus bears his own cross, a guy named Simon helps him out, Jesus predicts the ugly things that are going to happen in Jerusalem, and Jesus, of course, is going to this place called Golgotha. The last thing we learn in this portion of Jesus' crucifixion is in verse 34 of Matthew. What do they try to give Jesus to drink?
What is vinegar?
Yeah, it's vinegar. Gall is vinegar.
Okay.
But, so do they give him vinegar to drink?
No.
Wine.
Yeah, so it's wine and vinegar, right?
Yeah.
So is it a
like an anesthetic. That's exactly what it is. I mean, this may be an element of some compassion being extended. Sour wine. But does Jesus take it?
No.
Yeah, so why do you think that is?
Because he wanted to take the full brunt.
That's exactly right.
I don't think he wanted someone to say, well, he just got drunk up there.
That's exactly right. He knows that in order to fulfill Scripture, he needs to become sin and bear the punishment of sin, and to do that with a full and complete mind. He's a human being.
No epidural.
100% man. And 100% God. No epidurals. That's exactly right. Jeez. So we will move on next week with the beginning of the crucifixion. And,
All right.
Rod, before you get started, I just have one.